Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 3rd of March 2013. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Paul in London, Nick from Partially Obstructed View, and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about Glasgow Girls, which is it's a new musical that's just closed at the Stratford Theatre or Stratford East. It's directed by Cora Bissett, and it has a book by David Gregg. John, tell us more about this. And what you
think. I think a lot of us wanted to see this because David Gregg is the writer who has penned the book for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is about to open in London. But this is an older story of his, which started at the Glasgow Citizens Theatre last year. And it's based on historical fact. In the late 1990s, the city of Glasgow opened its least well-maintained tower blocks of flats to refugees fleeing war and persecutions in Europe and Africa, especially places like Kosovo and Somalia and so on. And by 2005, one child in eight at the local Drumchapel High School was an asylum seeker. After years of early rejection, the newcomers were eventually fiercely protected by the residents of the tenements against the authorities, if you like, particularly the Dawn raids in which failed asylum applicants and their families, including those who had children born in Scotland and could be presumed to have British or Scottish rights, were taken away for detention or repatriation. It's a passionate story, and it's told very strongly from the point of view of the group of schoolgirls, some local Glaswegian girls, some who were migrants and had become part of the community, who organised a protest against this sort of repatriation and brought it to the attention of the Scottish Parliament and later to Westminster. And I think it has influenced government attitude towards migrant families like that. In this particular version, the Glaswegian stereotype is assumed to just relish any kind of pitched battle with the authorities, and the musical follows the progress of the girls. But as I said, the narrative is rigorously partisan. The police and the border agents are all portrayed as a sort of faceless, thuggish automatons. They're like zombies. And the politicians are drawn as inept or uncaring. And anything that their parents might bring up by way of suggestion that maybe they don't want to, you know, make too much of a fuss here, is just brushed aside. So I think that there's possibly more to the story than you see in the musical. But that doesn't stop it being a kind of Glaswegian version of Blood Brothers. It's very community entrenched and strongly sung, strongly performed. Whether it's got a future as a West End musical or being the best stage play that any girls' school will ever put on, I'm not quite sure.
Paul, what did you think?
Well, actually, I was in two minds about whether I wanted to sit through the whole show, but that might have been for a variety of reasons. But I actually found myself really captivated by, I think, the performances in this show. And I think, as John rightly said, it is very one-sided. But actually, that is part of its interest, because you don't see anything else other than sort of how the girls react to the situations that are going around them. And that's quite interesting. If anything, I think, as a musical, though, I wasn't quite convinced that every song had demerit in the show, and actually I could have done with more of understanding about the predicament of these girls and also families who are refugees, and sort of the mindless sort of state that they're in because they can't get work, but you know, they have to go to school and all these sorts of things. And so over time they sort of became part of the community, but it's a sort of one or two songs sort of explain that, but then you don't actually get a sense of anything else about, you know, the struggles that they actually faced and things like that. But having said that, it's still quite an entertaining show, and, you know, the performances, I think, is what really keeps this, the interest in this.
Nick, what did you think?
Well, it sounds, from what the others have said, like I came out of this the most positive of the three of us. I certainly really enjoyed it. I really liked the variety of musical styles that got used throughout the show, and I mean, it's obviously very on theme to the idea of a multicultural blend with what's traditional about Scotland. And I think the kind of the soundscape of the show really does that very well. It really exemplifies what the story is trying to tell. And I agree, the performances are really just so energetic, so excited and exciting. I think it's pretty powerful. I think I absolutely agree that it's far too one-sided, and I think it's to the detriment of the show that it's that one-sided, because it kind of weakens its argument, because it presents there's one show in particular which is performed by one of the co-songwriters, who's rather fabulously called Patricia Panther, where she plays the kind of stereotype of the immigration officer, and her default position on everything is that everything's a lie, everybody's at it, as the song goes. And I think that weakens the argument. I don't just think it weakens the show, I think it weakens the argument. It makes it so obvious that you're just getting one side of the story, and I wished. I think a lot of it could have stayed the same, but with little hints that it's not just a faceless mass of baddies on the other end. I think that would have actually made it kind of politically, and as an argument, it would have made it stronger to see that. Especially because, I mean, one of the major things about the struggle they're in is that a lot of these people got sent back because on paper it was safe now where they'd come from. But actually, a lot of what the play is about these little grey areas where actually, in theory, a country is safe. But if you're in one particular little ethnic or religious or whatever group, it's not safe. Or there's just all the place or everything you came from is not there anymore. It's one of these things of... their whole argument is you know, well, you know, you're not it's not just that they're being taken away from where they're used to, it's they're genuinely being sent back to danger, and just using a generic qualification of whether that country's safe now doesn't apply. You've got to look into more detail. So I think it's a shame that in that context it looks at everybody on the other side without any kind of shades of grey. Without any idea that the people on the other side might have different opinions, and there might be specific circumstances and details on the other side of the argument. But I mean, that aside, I think it's very effective. I don't think it's been marketed very well. I think I saw the poster for it and thought, oh, I don't want to see that, and then I spotted that it was Cora Bissett and David Gregg, who I was very interested to see what they'd do together after Midsummer, where he wrote and directed and she acted. And now she actually she kind of came up with the idea for the piece and called in Greg to write the book for it, and she directs it as well. So if it wasn't for the creatives, I wouldn't have gone to see this. But I'm really glad I did. I think it's I don't know that it's quite as revolutionary as London Road, but it's along those kind of lines in terms of what it's doing as a musical that you don't see normally. Yes.
I think, though, the music is much better than London Road, I thought, and that also is much more significant to the story in this case, I felt. But, yeah, I know a lot of people love London Road, but London Road was not a show that I found was particularly interesting. But I think it's an interesting thing, though, in being so black and white about the authorities, they missed an opportunity, I think, to cover the whole plight of refugees, which is an incredibly grey area. And it was quite insightful in some respects, the little bits of information they did convey, because not knowing that you can't work, but you have to go, your children have to go to school, and then sort of the status of children in these sort of relationships, in these sort of situations, what happens to them. And then the whole thing about the dawn raids, like why do they do dawn raids and all that sort of stuff. It would have been quite fascinating to sort of understand what was the thinking process behind that as well, because it seemed bonkers. But yes, it would have been interesting to know a bit more about that.
It also must be the case that the officers who worked for the authorities must have grown up in that community as well, and there must have been, as Nick's sort of saying, at least one of them had some kind of crisis of conscience that he was going and turfing out his neighbours from their flats at 5 o'clock in the morning, and or she. Yeah. I think that it's slightly lazy journalistic research that they didn't find a story like that. The other story, and this is just a little piece of trivia that I think they might have grafted onto it, is the fact that James McAvoy grew up on that council estate, and his father still lives there.
We're now going to talk about Trelawney at the Wells, which is the new production on the Dunmar. This is directed by Joe Wright, who up till now has been a film director, and so this is his theatrical debut, as it were. He's responsible for plays like Anna Karenina, Atonement, and Pride and Prejudice, so he's very much, it seems, a Keira Knightley fan. Trelawney at the Wells is about a young woman called Rose Trelawney, the brightest star at the Sadler's Wells, it is the Sadler's Wells Theatre, I believe, in Islington, and she gives up the theatre company to get married. Unfortunately, when she lives on a trial basis with her fiancé's family, she finds she can't bear it and goes back to the theatre, but discovers that the theatre has sort of changed since she left. It's got a very promising-looking cast. I mean, we've got people like sort of old stages like Ron Cook and Maggie Steed and Peter White, who appear to be in everything. You've got Daniel Mays and Daniel Kaluuya providing some very good, interesting pieces, and Amy Fionn Edwards seeming to channel Paloma Faith, although somebody on Twitter, one of my friends on Twitter, didn't know who Paloma Faith was, so the joke was lost on him. But Amy Morgan as the Rose Trelawney, this production, I enjoyed the production. I liked the pieces. I liked the sort of the very fake elements of it. It's very in parts. It's very pantomimic, especially when you've got Ron Cook doubling as an old man and a theatrical landlady. It does have that slight feel about it. People popping up out of baskets to read letters and stuff like that. Sort of, and also the when they have the food coming in, it's. You've got a lot of obviously fake food, so it's deliberately sort of fake in those ways, but it works quite well. I didn't think much of the play, I have to say. It's been slightly played around with by Patrick Marber, but I'm not entirely sure what I wouldn't be able to tell what it was, because this is actually the first time I've seen this play. Yeah, it was fun, I thought, but I didn't really get anything deeper than that. It's interesting to see, and you know, it'll be interesting to see what Joe Wright does in the future in the theatre. Nick, what did you think about it?
Well, I don't know the play itself. I mean, I'd heard of it, but I'd never seen it before, so I don't know to what extent my reaction was to the play and what to the production. But I wasn't crazy about this at all. But I actually found, especially after the interval, I kind of put this together, because there was more scenes with fewer people on stage at any one time. I mean, this is, as you say, I mean, this is one hell of a cast. I mean, you look at the list of people in the cast list and you just go, oh, I really have to see this, because there's so many people I like in it. And I found that when there was a couple of people on stage together, it was fine, and you got some really nice performances out of them and some really nice relationships. But there's actually quite a lot of scenes where all or almost all of the cast are on the scene or on the stage at the same time. And I thought they were just absolutely dead. They just were a complete mess of sort of a lot of running around, but no kind of genuine joy or energy. It's kind of a lot of, as you say, a bit panto, but without the laughs. And I mean, people seem to be fairly positive about it, but I didn't hear a lot of laughs on the night. You know, there's I think the one person who made me laugh at one point was Amy Fionn Edwards, who is always very good. But then so are they all. You know, they're all really good people who, you know, in the scenes where there's only three people on stage, you get to kind of know the characters a bit better. You get to see them relate a bit better. But I don't know whether it's, I mean, it's very easy to make assumptions, because someone's coming in from film, where obviously you're close up on people. So maybe it's easy to kind of assume that it's that reason that Joe Wright couldn't quite pull it together for the sort of massive scenes of and unfortunately the first two acts, which is the bit before the interval, is almost entirely scenes where there's loads of people on stage, so everything everybody's doing is just getting lost in the kind of noise. And I just, myself and the friend I went with, just really didn't like it at all. And then we both much preferred it in the second half. But again, just when there's fewer people on stage, as soon as you kind of chuck everybody together, it's all really unfocused and really not funny. So it's another disappointment for me at the Donmar. But it has kind of its saving graces, but the overall picture of it is just not funny enough.
John, what did you think?
I'm possibly the only one of the three of us who's seen it before. And I saw the Toby Robertson production at the Comedy in 92 or 93. And if you think this is a good cast, if I tell you that Sarah Brightman was Trelawney, and the also-rans were Helena Bonham Carter, Jason Connery, Margaret Courtney, Michael Horden was the Vice-Chancellor, Kelly Hunter was Avonia, Joe Melia was in a little bit part. It was very, very well cast. And this one isn't by comparison. Although I felt that the smaller parts, the Vice-Chancellor, the landlady, his sister Trafalgar, I thought they were all very well done. But at the core of the play, the leads are weak. And you said that one of the girls was channeling Paloma Faith. I rather thought that Amy Morgan was channeling Amanda Seyfried, because all she seemed to do at the beginning was just simper in a white frog and sing at the top of her soprano range, which is more or less what Seyfried does all the way through Les Miserables. So I couldn't warm to it in anything other than a bit like the way Nick says, in a way that you kind of like elements of it, but maybe the whole is a little bit unsatisfactory. The thing I would say is it looks gorgeous, although it is very theatrical. And one of the things that always impresses me is the way that the Donmar manages to sort of transform itself into the drag of whatever show it's doing. So, you know, when it was doing Putnam County Spelling Bee, the whole auditorium and the corridors and the bars and everything have the pennants and the sort of school paraphernalia around. And here the set has been turned completely into a sort of lamp black stained Victorian music hall with great soaring columns and flickering oil lamps. I think Hildegard Bechtler has done her usual, you know, magnificent job. And it makes the Donmar look enormous. I don't think you've got that impression, because I often find it quite claustrophobic, but it seemed huge. And the kind of grandeur of the set, and then playing against it, this very theatrical mid-Victorian style of comedy, I thought worked quite well. But it's too long. But it's too slow to start. I really think that Joe Wright needs to learn something more about theatrical pace. I mean, I really think he needs to learn something about filmic pace as well, because in Anna Karenina, I couldn't wait for that bloody train to arrive. It just seemed to take forever. And this play is more or less the same. It is a quite a gentle plot, and it's fairly obvious what's going to happen, so it could be compacted. And I'm surprised Patrick Marber didn't take it more in hand. I can't myself either see where the joins are, because he has written seamlessly, and you cannot hear or tell where something has been introduced in the modern rewrite and what is Pinero's original. So that's well done, but I think he could have taken the pruning shears to it as well.
We're now going to talk about If You Don't Let Us Dream, We Won't Let You Sleep, which is a new play downstairs at the Royal Court. But it's got a very good cast. We've got people like Susan Brown, Mira Sayal, Thurdy Roberts, Lucien Masmati, and Laura Elphinstone. I'm not entirely sure that this play is all that good, though. I got rather put off, I have to say, by reading the reviews. I went on a couple of nights after it started, after it was after press night, so I'd read quite a lot of comments, quite a lot of reviews, and had been told that it's a kind of a very one-sided affair. We start off in this play with a group of people having a meeting about social impact bonds. These things actually exist, although I think in the play he doesn't talk about them as real, but as a brand new thing. Social impact bonds are basically, they get rich people to stump up a large amount of money to pay for social things. They've been done on homeless people and young offenders, sort of trying to stop reoffending. The idea is basically, I mean, pretty much it's at the moment the real social impact bonds are to do with giving a large amount of money, and then if the social aspects work out, so the reoffending rates go down or homelessness gets a bit more cleared up or eases, then the people who gave the money will get a fairly hefty interest rate back. I think in a Guardian article on the real social impact bonds, they're talking about they say that the investment's about $5 million and they could make a profit of about $3 million, which seems rather excessive. In this play, the social impact bonds seem to have got that they talk about seem to be much more led by sort of the bankers simply not actually wanting to take any risk at all of the bonds failing and wanting to maximise their amount of money, so they change the rules so that they will always make money and that they won't deal with sort of persistent offenders. In this case, it's modelled on the persistent offenders rather than the so you don't care, you don't put the money towards any of the really persistent offenders, you only put it towards the people who are simply not ever going to reoffend, you know, the people who only ever go to prison once and that's enough for them, so that it makes it look like a success and so they get paid. And it's a we get this, we also start getting as a consequence of this sort of imagined world where you suddenly get into the idea of a social debt. That it's not just the reoffending rates; they get put out to everything, and people start owing money. And there's actually a meter put in your house so that you have to pay off your social debt, or your electricity and everything else gets cut off. And this seems to me a bit of a step too far. We also get a slightly muddled story about immigrants and racism and things like that. And we finally end up with a group of activists who we've all been introduced to in the various stories he's put together, deciding to put the bankers on trial. And I have a lot of problems with this. I really hate being in a situation where I have to defend the bankers because, you know, they did terrible things. But as much as you might hate someone like Fred Godwin because he is a terrible person and a terrible human being, it's very difficult to point out actually what crimes he committed. He was an incompetent, he was an idiot, and he was exceptionally greedy and took absolutely no responsibility for his failings. But he didn't actually commit a crime. This is the head of RBS who sort of demanded his massive pension, having really mucked the bank up, but he didn't commit a crime. He mucked everything up, but, you know, it's all very well putting the bankers on trial, but you've got to have an idea of exactly what they did wrong. And I think one of the biggest problems about this is that he hasn't got the faintest idea what the bankers did wrong. In fact, they pretty much say that in the play. They are putting on this trial and they don't know what the defence case should be for the bankers. They even have a banker there and they just lecture the banker about Mesopotamians, you know, having debt holidays so that, you know, you could give everything up, and that perhaps that's what we ought to be doing. We should simply give up debt, you know, should simply let people, everybody off debts. And that is an interesting argument, but I would have liked to see the counter arguments as well. It's just accepted as truth. This is sort of so one-sided, as the critics unfortunately said, that I was really offended by it, because, I mean, it's something I tend to associate with the left wing, especially in this country, although Anders Lustgarten, I think, is of American extraction. But the left wing, especially in this country, they exaggerate, they make straw man arguments, so they basically build the straw man and then you destroy it and say, look how weak the straw man is. Well, you built the straw man, you know. It's you can't do this if you want to win the argument. If you want to win the argument, you've got to go up against the best, you've got to sort of debate with people who really don't agree with you, who really want to, you know, who really have good arguments on their side. It's no good putting up people who don't have any arguments on their side, as if they're just evil and greedy and that's all there is to it. There is much more to it. And they really need to have somebody who will, you know, take the arguments up, you know, take his arguments apart. He doesn't want to know about those people. He's obviously not even thought about them. And as I say, there is this admission in there that they don't really know what the problem is or what the solutions are. You know, he just doesn't understand it, and it really wrecked what could be a good play. And I really wish the drama department, the literary department at the Royal Court, had sort of sat him down and said, put someone in there who's got the good arguments, who can sort of change the way you think about it, because this is just so one-sided, and it makes it look inept. And, you know, it's not a good, it's preaching to the choir, and it's just not a good enough debate. And I think that's what he wants to have, but he just, you know, he's not interested in listening or understanding the other people. And it's such a shame, because you've got a really good cast in here, and you know, a lot of good people involved with this, but it's just so disappointing, I thought. What do you think about it, Nick?
Right, and breathe. You've got that out of your system. I think again I'm going to be the slightly more positive voice this week, although again I agree with a lot of what you're saying. Funnily enough, same as Glasgow Girls, it's got that issue of not really looking at the other side of the argument. I think, I mean, for me, what I mainly took out of it was the real kind of polemic he's got about this, not the idea that we shouldn't have to pay someone else's debt, which I think is just common sense that everybody knows but just accepts that we're going to, but also this thing that he argues that it's against international law, that the austerity politics is against international law because we didn't personally choose to bail out the banks. So putting people's kind of homes and shelter and food secondary to that, health is against international law. I do agree that with a lot of what you said, but like I say, I think I came out of it a lot more positive than you. I think where it falls down for me is as a piece of theatre, because it is very muddled and it is essentially a big build-up to a lecture on this subject. And the thing with this kind of, which as you say is not entirely made up, but the way he treats it is kind of this dystopian extreme of the bonds, where essentially they're bonds that pay out if you improve society, and they just apply market forces to them, so they can I think it's called shorting or something like that. I watched Money the Game Show a couple of weeks ago, so I should remember the terms. But there you go.
Shorting is saying it's going to fail.
Yes, which is what they end up doing. This is kind of that they end up betting. They end up making their money if they fail, if society gets worse. So therefore, it just speeds up how quickly it does. They kind of give up on improving society. So it's kind of this high concept that starts it off, but it is essentially a way into this big lecture at the end. And although I found the lecture itself interesting, it is still a lecture. So I think theatrically it falls down. But I mean, I agree, it's just such a great cast again. You've got most people playing a number of different roles, and there's only two, I think. There's Susan Brown, who plays the older lady who gets one of these meters put in her home because she can't afford to pay the debt tax. And Daniel Kendrick, who plays, for me, the character who kind of exemplifies the title. He's the person who kind of has his dreams taken away from him by the state, because they kind of decide initially, when the bonds are working the way they're supposed to, that they're going to rehabilitate him. And then once they realize they can make more money if he fails, he's kind of the system goes against him. So it encourages him to fail, because some people in a bank somewhere are going to make more money if he commits more crimes. So I don't know. I mean, I came out of it probably because I just am a raving lefty, but I didn't come out of it that negatively. But certainly theatrically, it's missing something. But I think it works in its own terms. And I think what I liked about it, and I think you don't see very much of, is even if it's incredibly kind of naive and misguided, at least it's optimistic. Which I think, I mean, I was talking, I think I was talking on here a few weeks ago about Simon Stevens kind of going on about how Port is a really optimistic piece, because at the end, if you do dump everything you've ever known and run away, then maybe your life won't be a misery. Whereas here you've kind of got a genuine kind of belief, albeit a naive one, that you can kind of fight and change the world and should fight and change the world. So even if it kind of doesn't quite all fall together, I like that as a I think that's something we're maybe missing at the moment in political theater. So it's certainly a mixed bag. I mean, I assume that the short run is because they were leaving themselves, as they often do, a gap to kind of extend if it went well, which obviously they've not ended up using, so it's obviously not really been a huge success. I think it's definitely worth seeing. It's got maybe, like I say, naive things to say, but it's got a lot to say.
Yeah, I just wish the arguments were better.
Yeah,
it's one of those things where I'm not exactly a raving lefty, and I'm certainly not right wing. I hope, but when you can sort of say hold it, you know, you just sit there thinking, oh, hold it, no, that's not right, you know, you can't say that, you've made that up, you know, you're not really addressing the issues. I mean, you just say bland things, austerity doesn't work. Well, why doesn't it work? You know, don't just say it doesn't work, because that's because there are an awful lot of, you know, smart people who do actually have the best, you know, the people's best interests at heart, who do think it works, you know. And so what's going on there? You can't just come out with saying that, but you're not going to sort of get me interested or get me to follow you if you say things like that. But you're not going to get me to understand it.
No, I think ultimately its problem is that it's certainly not going to influence anybody, which of course is its main purpose. Anders Lusgaarden is primarily a full-time activist, and obviously what he's trying to kind of affect people's opinions. And I think its biggest flaw is that it's really not going to do that at all, because as you say, even if you can see the argument he's making, you can also see where he's not backing it up properly, and you can see other sides to it. And like I say, again, as with Glasgow Girls, you go, well, if you kind of put the other side of it a bit more sympathetically, or at least accept that there is another side to the argument, then it actually strengthens yours a lot more. So I think that is where a lot of its weakness lies. I found it interesting in its way, but I think it's theatrically it's quite disappointing, and story wise it's just lots of loose ends, and it is a bit. Kind of naive, I've said a few times, but it is really in many ways. I wouldn't want everything to be written like this, but I'm kind of glad that it's out there, that every so often there's something that's a bit kind of desperately unsubtle but kind of really believes in something.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are ayu-londontheatre.org, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.